for me, there is just what's the task selection. So the task should reflect the intensity, the ground contact times. It should reflect stretch shortening cycle nature of movements, and it should basically reflect those biomechanical demands of how people get injured.
Welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast, the podcast that dives into the philosophies, ideas, and practices of some of the best practitioners in high-performance sport. This episode of the podcast is with Matt Buckthorpe, and it's all about ACLs. So we're taking you from early stage, or even pre-op preparation, through early stage into mid-stage and late-stage rehabilitation from ACLs. So we go from criteria. So what are the entry and exit criteria of each of these stages? Then Matt breaks it up even further, especially in that late stage where we spend a lot of our time in this episode. So if you're a strength and conditioning coach, rehab professional, you're a physiotherapist, you're rehabbing athletes, not only for ACLs, but long-term rehabs, this episode is definitely for you because you'll take absolutely tons from it. The level of detail that Matt goes into in this episode is incredible. So listen, get your pen, get your pencil, get your notebook and start writing. So over to Matt. This episode of the Pacey Performance Podcast is sponsored by Team Builder. Team Builder is a software for performance coaches around the world. The powerhouse platform increases efficiency, saves paper, and can handle any type of programming. It's the perfect fit for professional and academy teams, performance institutes, schools, and universities. Team Builder is full of tools that help coaches' needs. Multiple max tracking methods, 16 plus reports, evaluation testing, and goal setting, just to name a few. Coaches also have access to consultations with Team Builder's in-house sports scientist to help manage and analyze data. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code SPORTSMITH to start your 30-day free trial. Also sponsoring this episode is Rockdaisy. Rockdaisy's athlete management system provides a powerful competitive advantage to elite sports leagues around the world. If you're looking for a solution that enables you to centralize, analyze, and visualize your data, check out rockdaisy.com and sign up for a free trial. So without further ado, over to the episode with Matt. Matt Buckthorpe, welcome to the Pacey Performance Podcast. Thank you for giving up some of your morning.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for the invitation. Yeah, my pleasure.
No, thank you. Thank you for coming on. We've had quite a bit of content recently around ACL. We obviously know the burden that it puts on professional clubs, organisations, down to weekend warriors. So I'm really excited to get you on and dive into the various different stages, some of the movement quality stuff. But before we do dive into that, would you mind just giving us a bit of an intro to you? What you're doing now, what you've been doing previously?
Yeah, sure, of course. Currently I'm a senior lecturer at St. Mary's University. So it's kind of a hybrid role between strength and conditioning science and physiology. Now just gone part-time, and I also consult to Isokinetic Medical Group, based more around research and education of their group, and then sort of helping them on their service innovation as well. So I've been, linked with Isokinetic for 10, 11 years. I was originally a rehab specialist in their London clinic, so 5 or 6 years there. And yeah, been consulting to their education and research department for the last 5 or 6 years as well. Background, sport and exercise scientist, S&C coach principally. I was a failed athlete, which we all like to go that way. Always wanted to go into coaching, and sort of during my internships in football clubs, I got very interested in end-stage rehab, on-field rehab in particular. So I spent a bit of time at Fulham. There was an excellent on-field rehab coach there. I'm sure you won't mind me saying, Sean Reed, who really got me massively interested in that area. And then an opportunity came up at Isokinetic Medical Group sort of 11 years ago, and I really wanted to learn more about sports medicine. And I had a real passion for end-stage rehab, injury prevention. I just wanted to upskill a lot in sports medicine. So, I joined Isokinetic about 11 years ago, and been very focused since then around rehab, return to play, and particularly ACL injuries, which is my main area of research. Prior to all of that, I did a PhD at Loughborough around neuromuscular function, neural control. So a lot of my stuff, I come out from a neural sort of neuromuscular area as well. So that's kind of my background.
Just from a personal perspective, my interest in obviously understanding more about you and what you do, IsoKinetic, obviously they've got the clinics, they've got the conference. What else is going on, like different arms of the business?
Italian company. So they've got 7 clinics out in Italy and they've got 1 in London. So London clinic's been there, since I was there, 2012. And they also have an education and research department where the conference kind of fits. And I think a lot of people either saw them as clinics or saw them as a conference producer. They've kind of done the conference for 30 or so years now, so it's always closely linked to their clinics. They're kind of expanding. They've got a virtual clinic as well. But, most of their focus is their private practice orthopedic sports medicine clinic. They treat a range of patients from the general population through to elite sporting athletes. Their, main clinic is Bologna. And Bologna is where the education and research department sits. And so they host the largest football medicine conference. They're a FIFA medical center of excellence. So they've got quite a strong link with FIFA. And the uniqueness probably is that education and research department. So they do actually do research. We've published a good body of research, probably 50 papers over the last 5 years or so, which is quite good for a very small family company. And they're not a university, so it's not about doing well in the league tables. It's obviously trying to answer those questions. So that's kind of what attracted me personally, was they've got a really good conference, they do research, and they're also working with a lot of high profile professional athletes as well.
Nice. Perfect. Always been interested in that. Obviously I know the conference and the clinics, but pretty know the background to it and
kind of a lot of people, they thought they just hosted conferences. Which is always a bit you want to link it back into what you do day to day.
Of course. So right, let's dive into the ACL side of things. And like I said, and like you mentioned it in the email that you sent to me, we've had quite a lot of info when it comes to ACLs, and I think pretty now more than ever, than if you'd agree that the spotlight is firmly on ACLs. But would you mind just giving us a bit of a brief outline of the kind of the stages, even pre-op, and then early stage, which you've done some nice work in recently, mid-stage, late stage, and then we'll dive into each of them individually.
Obviously, really, it's from the point of injury. So fundamentally, if you do want to learn about your ACLs, then do have a deep dive into the injury mechanism stuff, because that understanding that injury is pretty key. But someone gets injured, rupture their ACL, professional athlete would typically have surgery pretty soon. So most professional athletes will generally have surgery within the first sort of 7 to 10 days. But the key thing is that the knee is quiet. There's not, there isn't a restriction in range of motion. There is not a huge amount of swelling, and there is good quad recruitment, quad strength in that knee. But if you do it quite soon, you're not going to get a lot of muscle atrophy. So hopefully you'll go into that pretty well. Pre-op varies across lots of different people, in that if you're a professional athlete and you're going in surgery really quick, that pre-op period is really, really short. You will get people who do delay the ACL reconstruction. And there's a lot of people pushing for delay in that ACL reconstruction to identify what's called copers versus non-copers. So there is a large proportion of people that can potentially cope without having an ACL, and they can get back to a range of sporting tasks, including playing football. So there are a few case studies out there that professional players have got back, haven't had surgery, got back within 2 months, and they're back playing for a good couple of years. But the process really depends on the person, the stage of their career, their age. If you're dealing with a 21-year-old, elite level footballer, that's going to be very different to a 35-year-old professional player. And so I guess, designing the overall process, first start with the end in mind. So I do like that reverse engineering concepts where you look at where you need to get to, and then you work your way back. But fundamentally, we've got to try and get players back to play as quick as possible. So I do believe in doing it as fast as you can, but making sure that they go back at the necessary performance level and they've got a low risk of injury. Now, that's really hard to do quickly. So, get them back as fast as you can, but it is going to take probably on average sort of 6 to 8 months for a professional player, and then probably looking around 12 months for a recreational athlete. In terms of the process, yeah, you've got pre-op stage, which can be either very short or can be 6 to 12 weeks preparation. Then you go into early, mid, late, and then the return to sport continuum. So Isokinetic, and the way I used to work, was always a phased approach: phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, phase five. But I kind of never really got that, because for me, phase three could mean anything, because you could have 6 phases or 5 phases or 4 phases. So I kind of have gone with the early, mid, late, because it gives a bit of time context to it. So early stage basically is immediately post-op for kind of the first 4 to 8 weeks of rehab. And really what you're trying to do there is overcome surgery, recover activities of daily living. And I guess the key milestone is, can you get patients off the crutches, walking without crutches with good sufficient gait? And can they go about their normal lives? Because prior to that point, there's a certain dependency on support from individuals. And that's what I got from this early stage paper, some really great input from Ross Wadey around the social support structures that are in place for athletes, because they are dependent on other people for getting around, transport, cooking dinners. And so it's kind of the end of that early stage sort of means that people can be a bit more independent. They're off the crutches, they can do normal activities of daily living, the knee's quiet, there's not a huge amount of pain, not a huge amount of swelling. So once you go from early, you're into the mid stage. That is a little bit longer. The reason it's a longer stage is because one of the hardest things to do after ACL reconstruction is to recover quad strength. And you can't transition into late stage rehab until you've got sufficient knee extensor, so quadricep muscle strength. And so the length of the stage will vary. And it really depends on what's the quad weakness going into the stage. So some people will enter with a 30% deficit versus the other side. Other people will enter with a 60% deficit. So on average, it might take 2% a week. You might have a 2% improvement in strength each week. So if you're starting at 30%, it's a lot easier to get back to the 20% that you need to go into late stage. So I have a limb symmetry index of 80% to go into late stage. So if you need to recover 40%, that's going to take you a long amount of time at 2% a week. So it's a good period of time there. Mid-stage rehab really is, the main focus is recovering quad strength, making sure the knee's still nice and quiet, good range of motion, trying to get back to running on a treadmill, and sufficiently preparing our athletes to go into the late stage. So that's sufficient physical fitness, good movement patterns, overcoming major muscle imbalances, so that when they do enter late stage rehab, where there's a lot more jumping, landing, they've got the necessary physical capacity to be able to tolerate that. Late stage rehab is about really transitioning an athlete from an 80% limb symmetry index of the quads. They probably can run on a treadmill, but they can't do any other movement type tasks, so they're not cutting, they're not decelerating. It's taking them from the ability to run in a straight line to being able to do high intensity pre-planned change of direction drills on the field. So it's really recovering the physical capacities to perform most sporting movements. But those sporting movements are sort of pre-planned, so changing direction, 180 cuts, 90 degree cuts, accelerating, obviously running at high speeds, and doing all of that with sufficient movement quality and not having those imbalances in place. And then, yeah, return to sport training is where the shift really focuses on whatever sport you're doing. So if it's football, it's on-field rehab that's football-focused, restoring their technical drills, moving towards like reactive movements, training them onto fatigue, all of those sport-specific contextual factors. And readying them for return to training. So on-field rehab is that bridge to from the in-clinic to the team training. Then you go from team training to gradual restoration back to competitive match play. And then you're gradually feeding them back into their return to performance as well. So I guess that's kind of the overall thing is, early, mid, late, return to sport continuum. There are some key objectives that allow you to progress along the way. I like to use criterion-based rehab, so I have set criteria at each stage to help you transition across. And then probably a key part there is recognizing the different services that's available. So obviously you've got your your physio-based rehab. You'll have your reconditioning-based S&C stuff. You'll have your hydrotherapy, which I'm a huge fan of in ACL rehab, but a lot of people don't have a pool, so it's not spoke about as much. This kind of movement environment, non-field rehab, it's balancing all of those different environments to maximize them, and then just gradually taking that athlete through from the point of injury back to return to play. And hopefully when you make that decision on return to play, they're at the right performance level, they can pass return sport criteria, but they're also pretty safe going back. And there's a big difference between return to play and re-injury risk. A lot of the factors that help us get back to play don't protect us from an injury. So it's sort of balancing all of those bits as well. So I won't talk for a whole hour.
No, you're all good. I could just let you go. We'll dive into that late stage, that moving from the pre-plan to the complex a little bit later on. I'm really interested to get that, because the majority of the audience for the podcast, as we know, is S&C coaches predominantly. Those that are looking after that super late stage, I think it'd be most relevant to them. But I'd like to have a little chat around the dimensions of the early stage, and in your recent paper at the six dimensions of that early stage ACL rehab. Would you mind just expanding on that a little bit? And just so we can understand that phase, and then we'll jump to the end.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously I've kind of highlighted six dimensions. Now, this is, I guess, new in that a lot of discussions with the co-authors on the paper, particularly Lee Harrington, around this, sort of highlighting those dimensions. So a lot of the time, the early stage is very much focused on the joint and addressing pain and swelling and recovery of gait is normally what people focus on. So getting the knee quiet, overcoming swelling, getting full range, full knee extension, so at least 0 degrees. So you can't have good gait unless you've got 0 degrees extension. So if you've got like a fixed flex deformity or whatever, if you've got five degrees restriction, you can't walk properly because you need full extension to be able to walk. So the first two is pain and swelling. And the reason for that is because pain and swelling has a profound effect on joint proprioception, causes muscle inhibition, and pain is obviously an indicator that something's going wrong within the joint. Swelling also causes inhibition, so swelling will directly inhibit the quads through arthrogenic muscle inhibition, but swelling also prevents full range of motion. So if you've got swelling in the joint, you can't recover quad extension, you can't get full knee flexion. So you can't get good range of motion unless you address pain and swelling. And then recovery of range of motion, so lots of active and passive tasks to try and get the knee back to full extension and get at least kind of around 110, 120 degrees knee flexion. In that, again, you need good knee flexion to have good gait. You can't get on a cycle, a stationary bicycle, unless you've got 110, 120 degrees of knee flexion. And the bike is a really good tool in the early stage to get that range of motion recovery and that fitness. And then beyond that, it's kind of the third one for me is quadricep strength recovery, or just general strength. Now, what happens in the early stage is a lot of people are very risk averse, and this leads to a lot of muscle atrophy. And the more muscle atrophy you're going to get at the quad, the harder it's going to be to get that recovery back in the mid stage. So having a sufficient amount of work in the early stage to preserve that quadricep strength and preserve the muscle size is really key. There's a lot of techniques that you can do. You can't use a conventional strength and conditioning approach because the person's in pain, they've got swelling, and that's going to cause arthrogenic inhibition. So arthrogenic muscle inhibition means that you're trying to contract your quad, you're trying to do a knee extension type task. You can't recruit all of those available motor units because there's some inhibition coming back from the joint. So the joint is sending some afferent input back to the spinal column that's preventing you from recruiting your quadricep muscle. So it basically means you can only recruit a certain amount of motor units. And if you can't recruit them, you can't provide a stimulus to be able to preserve them. So that arthrogenic inhibition is why it's so challenging to do proper strength training in the early stage. But it's not just that, because you've got the joint that you need to protect as well. So if you do the wrong task, you can stretch that ACL. So there's a lot of fear around open kinetic chain in the early stage, which is, I'll be honest, I don't really know. In that I've explored all the literature and I've still got some level of uncertainty. I do think you need to do open kinetic chain, but I can see some of the surgeon perspective around protecting the graft and particularly protecting what's called the incorporation sites, where the pins in essence have gone into the bone. So the actual tendon that's gone in is really strong. So obviously you might be grafting with the patella tendon, so quad tendon or bone patella tendon. The actual tendon is really strong, and that goes through a process where it converts to a ligament for a long period of time. But the tendon is really strong, but it's actually the points where that's gone into the bone that's really weak. So you don't want to have a graft pull where the graft gets pulled out from the bone. So there are some precautions in that early stage that mean that you can't just do lots of conventional strength training. So that's why in the paper that we've just published, I've got lots of recommendations on supplementary modalities. So using things like neuromuscular electrical stimulation, which is good because if you can't recruit the muscle voluntarily via the nervous system, you can directly recruit it with electrical activity at the point of the muscle. That helps overcome the spinal inhibition that happens. Blood flow restriction training is used a lot now. Where BFR is really good is that you can't do high load in the early stage because you've got to protect the joint, you've got inhibition, you just can't use high load. So BFR is good because it allows you to get a lot of metabolic byproducts so you can fatigue the muscle. So yeah, we do a lot of this in S&C, but there's a few different strategies of getting muscle hypertrophy. We know there's metabolic byproducts, there's mechanical tension, and there's eccentric contractions. You can't go heavy load, so mechanical tension's off, and you can't really do eccentric high intensity. So you've got to go through it, metabolic adaptations. So it's all around trying to fatigue the muscle to get that improvement in hypertrophy. So BFR becomes really useful in the early stage.
Jump in, Matt.
Yeah.
Have you got any guidance on how or different pressures, any guidance on BFR? I know there's loads out there now, even more and more.
Yeah, I'd probably lean on Stephen Patterson and Luke Hughes' work on that. So definitely Stephen Patterson, who does have some guidance on it. There's obviously a lot of different companies now, but Stephen Patterson has got some stuff out there. So there's a couple of recommendations in the paper. There is a shift typically from passive BFR through to active BFR at different stages. And there is normally in the early stage, right at the beginning, it's normally passive BFR plus neuromuscular stim. But then you start to go active BFR from about 3 weeks onwards. So there's a tiny bit in the paper that we've wrote, but then Stephen does have additional resources that he's made recommendations around cuff pressures, cuff size, you know, exactly how to do it. So yeah, I would read some of that stuff, and again, I can zip across a couple of papers if you want after, if you want to highlight anything.
You've done two bloody brilliant podcasts as well that people can tap into, so link them to.
Yeah, exactly. And I'd say Stephen's really the expert on the paper there, and he's got a lot of good stuff out there. Equally, Luke Hughes has got some good stuff, but obviously, I'm St. Mary's biased there, so there are other good people in the world doing some good stuff as well.
Sorry, I interrupted. Then carry on.
Cross education is quite key now. So I've kind of highlighted like this neural inhibition stuff. We've got to overcome neural inhibition, and you can do that through exercise, but you can also use certain strategies to address it as well. So one of them you can use is like joint cooling at the start of the session. So the pain at the knee is causing inhibition. So what you can do is use joint cooling, so ice on the knee, before you do your quadricep strength training. That then reduces the pain at the knee, desensitizes it, increases activation, and you get a better bang for your buck on your quadricep strengthening as well. There's a couple of other things like that TENS, transcutaneous electrical nerve stim, and then cross-education, which is probably where the S&C coaches will be more interested, is that you can do strength training on the other leg. What happens when we strength train is we get both morphological and neural adaptations. But by training our uninjured leg, we can get neural adaptations that then lead to improvements on the other side. So you can overcome that spinal and supraspinal inhibition, and you can help reduce that on the other side as well. And that means that you can facilitate increased strength on that leg. But it's really just incorporating a load of strategies to overcome pain, swelling, overcome inhibition, and then safely load the quads to get a good stimulus. So it's not easy. It is challenging. And I can see why people do get worried, and they tend to not then load the quad. But then that means that we get massive, massive muscle atrophy, massive strength deficits. And that's what leads to a really complex rehab process is that the further that quad strength comes down, the harder it gets. As soon as you start getting 60-70% deficits, you get loads of pain at the knee, you can't get full extension, you can't walk properly, and you just get stuck in around that phase. So that's, for me, was probably the most important bit of the paper, was how can we try to give some safe guidance on recovering quad strength a little bit sooner, so that people don't enter that valley of despair, in essence, where you're kind of stuck. And then, yeah, a couple more dimensions are, don't just focus on the quad. There is also some hamstring stuff that you need to do. Particularly, probably one of the key bits from the paper from this is that a lot of people say don't load the hamstring 6 to 8 weeks after ACL reconstruction when you've used a hamstring graft, which just doesn't make sense, because basically if you're using a hamstring graft, you've got an ACL reconstruction plus you've got a grade 4 hamstring tear. Now, if you were to rehab someone with a hamstring reconstruction, you wouldn't just leave them for 8 weeks. So basically it's using your ACL protocol plus your hamstring severe tear protocol as well. And it's just bringing that in, making sure that you're getting some safe loading to the hamstring in the early stage, so that you don't get those issues. It's just logical, but there's about two papers out there just saying leave it till it's 8 weeks. And that's what everyone's tending to do. So that's probably a key part there. And then if you're working with a pro, you know, include some stuff in around the calf. So focus distally, focus proximally, address lumbar pelvic issues, glute med, lumbar pelvic control, stability factors as well. And then fourth one is around movement quality restoration. Now, movement quality should be a running theme right the way throughout your ACL rehab, right from the beginning through to the end. Often what happens is people focus on movement quality at the end. And then you don't have enough time. But there's a really good opportunity to train people's movement patterns right from the beginning in the pool. And it should be a focal theme all the way through to return to play. And you've got maybe 6 to 8 months there to really ingrain some good movement patterns. And movement training's challenging, and you need as long as possible to try and get those adaptations. The fourth dimension's just focus on movement quality, focus on good gait recovery, try and get a good symmetrical bilateral squat. So when you do start loading them, you've addressed some of those movement impairments. And if you've got a bad squat at 4 weeks, that typically leads to long-standing squat impairments right the way through, even at 12 months, some research has shown. And again, if you've got poor gait mechanics, that leads to poor running mechanics at 4 months. So trying to address these things early helps us as we progress on. I'd say do a lot of that stuff in the pool early on if you've got access to a pool. I know a lot of people don't have access to a pool. But the pool is basically like an anti-gravity room. So you can stick someone in a swimming pool. If you're doing exercise around chest height, you've got about 60% reduction in body mass, which means the reason you couldn't walk in the first place was because the quad was really weak. Now you put them in the pool. Now you can suddenly get good gait from people as well. So the only precaution there is if you've got a hamstring graft, don't start doing loads of really high intensity running in the pool, because you will rupture the hamstring. But yeah, kind of fourth dimension, focus on movement. The fifth one, thanks to Moore Ross Wadey, was around psychological factors, but also social and environmental factors as well. So obviously there's a series of psychological factors we need to address quite early on. But the key bit for me in that paper was that there's a lot of social support structures that are available to people that they need help from. So when you have an ACL reconstruction, you're reliant on people. Your sense of independence goes. And so you need to do what's called that relationship mapping, where you look at what's your potential social support structures, and then trying to draw on that help from people. And, you know, and sometimes that might mean that you do your rehab at a different environment, where you go back to where your family are. And I think sometimes we need to think about, is the team environment always the best environment? Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But just having social support around you is really, really important. And then finally, just physical fitness restoration. So making sure that we just do a little bit of conditioning work, particularly in our professionals. I wouldn't recommend this in recreational people because they haven't got the financial resources typically. But including a little bit of fitness preservation work in our professionals. So upper body strength work, upper body cardiovascular conditioning, nutrition control, just so they don't hit kind of 10, 12 weeks and they've put on, you know, a couple of stone and they've got deconditioned. Just trying to preserve that a little bit. But importantly, with the physical fitness, that should never compromise the other dimensions. So the dimensions don't fit separately. They're all kind of interlinked. And some of them help each other. So you can't recover range of motion unless you address pain and swelling. Physical fitness restoration and preservation should never compromise the joint. So it's the secondary focus. Never cause pain, swelling from physical fitness. Sometimes people do get a little bit too focused on that too early. So you've got to have your priority list, which is get the knee straight, get it nice and quiet, get them back walking and preserve that quad. They're your key factors. Cool. Yeah, hopefully that's kind of an overview. It's a pretty big area. And one thing I found with it is I learned loads working with the co-authors, and there's a surgeon on there, sports docs, some top class physios on there. And I learned a hell of a lot from those guys. And you realize how interdisciplinary that phase is, that stage is. It's much more medicalized than it is performance-based. It should be certainly physio/doctor/surgeon led. It's a really complex area, and I can see why people do struggle a little bit. So that's my main thing with writing that paper, was it's quite challenging and there's not a lot of guidance out there. So hopefully that will help give people a little bit of advice. There's a lot of people on the paper that know a lot more about it than I do. So hopefully that's useful.
So we're just going to take a very quick break in the chat with Matt. Hope you're enjoying part one. So over in part two, as you'd expect, we keep going through the stages and we spend a lot of time on that late stage where Matt goes into tons of detail and breaks that late stage up even further. We go into developing drills, moving from closed drills to more open chaotic drills. So really interesting part two coming up. This episode of the Pace of Performance podcast is sponsored by Vald. So I'm really proud to have Vald as a sponsor again. And after a recent visit to Vald HQ in Brisbane for their annual ValdCon event, it's incredible to see how far they've come as a company since I last visited at the start of 2018. So from a very humble office of less than 20 employees back then, it's amazing to see how far they've come. They now employ a global team of more than 200 that support clients across 100 countries, including many of the world's elite and professional sporting organizations. So an incredible rise to where they are now. So this is a huge testament to just the impact they're having across the industry with their innovation, but also continued commitment to support clients. So if you're a performance practitioner, you probably know all about Vald, but if not, I'd recommend that you check them out at valdperformance.com. And also sponsoring this episode is Hytro. Have you ever tried blood flow restriction training? So for pro sport teams and athletes, Hytro is the only performance BFR brand to create pressure-validated BFR wearables that are practical, safe, and scalable, allowing you to enhance recovery and maximize athletic potential like never before. Widely used by top-flight rugby, football, cricket, and motorsports teams already in post-game changing rooms, away game travel, hotels, or at home, Hytro has proven that creating their simple and effective wearables allows BFR to be delivered to athletes and squads simultaneously and safely. To find out how Hytro BFR can give your athletes a competitive edge, visit hytro.com or email the team at teamsales@hytro.com. Would you mind just giving us a bit of an insight into the criteria that you use to transition athletes or patients from one phase to the next? I think that'd be really helpful and really insightful for the listener.
Yeah, definitely. So, criterion-based we have for me is key. Or having certain checkboxes along the way that you're working to. So it doesn't need to be at a particular stage. It can just be that you've got certain criteria that you do want to hit. The main reason for that is that you can't do certain tasks unless you have the prerequisites for it. So, for instance, you can't walk on, you can't get off the crutches unless you've got 0 degrees knee extension. So there are certain tick boxes that you need to progress along. Obviously, the ACL pathway gets more and more intense as we go along, and there are certain times we do want to address key aspects. So the early stage criteria that I've set is based on, and all of the criteria is based on kind of nice to haves and must haves. So there are certain must have criteria. So early stage criteria, the must have is low levels of pain, so it's 0 to 2, low levels of swelling. So you can use like the sweep test, you need trace or zero swelling. 0 degrees extension, 110, 120 degrees knee flexion, sufficient quadricep activation. So there's different ways of doing this, but the clinical way of doing it is a quad sag test, which is basically, can you contract your quad, get your knee in full extension, and can you go into a straight leg raise? And if your knee is dropping into flexion, it means you can't sufficiently recruit your quad to maintain full extension. If you can't do that, you can't maintain full extension in walking, because your quad is important to stabilize the knee, of course, when you're walking. So if you haven't got sufficient quadricep recruitment, you can't get sufficient walking pattern. And you don't want to load someone in the mid stage if they've got inhibition, because if you start loading them on an inhibition, you're not going to get the desired results that you want. You're then going to get patellofemoral pain, and it's going to get a lot more complex. So first address that inhibition issue, and then when you do start loading them, you'll get better returns off your strength work. And then that's pretty much the early stage. And then there are a couple of nice to haves. So if you can do some quadricep strength testing, that's great, just to understand where they're at. Now, obviously, that's dependent on access to equipment. So some people might do some manual muscle testing. This whole area like needs exploring a bit more. But I'm a big fan of an isometric 90-degree knee extension on an isokinetic machine, or just isometrically with a handheld dynamometer. The reason you do it at 90 degrees is because a lot of surgeons are worried about loading in the open kinetic chain. So ACL loading changes based on the angle. And so if you do knee extensions at 0 degrees, so full extension or 10 degrees flexion, 20 degrees flexion, you get a lot more strain through the ACL. But if you do it in 90 degrees, you get 0% strain. So it's safe to do isometric 90 degree knee extension just to get a measure of strength. Ideally, you get a limb symmetry index about 60%. So that's strength on the injured versus the uninjured leg, only a 40% deficit across limbs. If it's much bigger than that, there's probably some problems around pain and swelling that you need to address. So there's no point doing heavier strength training. You're better off overcoming that inhibition and trying to get them to a point they can sufficiently recruit the quad. And then, yeah, basically also maybe do a bilateral squat as well. Just look at the loading pattern. You should be ingraining a good bilateral squat pattern in the early stage, whether that's in the pool or in the gym. Obviously, you want a good bilateral squat before you start loading. So doing your goblet squats, your overhead squats, your back squats, your conventional squat work, which should be a running theme through mid-stage. But if you've got a bad bilateral squat going into it, that's because there's some unloading and there's some fear of loading through that limb. So if you start loading that person in a loaded back squat, then that's only going to get worse and you're going to create those movement pattern issues. And then similar kind of theme at the mid stage and late stage. Mid stage, the principal criteria is quadricep strength at least 80% versus the other side. That's in an isokinetic test, but it's the same if you do handheld dynamometer. It's probably a little bit higher handheld dynamometer. But yeah, I'd say 80% limb symmetry index there. You should be able to run on a treadmill with good running mechanics. You should have good hamstring strength. So again, 80% limb symmetry index. You should have good movement patterns. So if you can't do a good single leg squat and you can't do a good bilateral landing with good technique, when you start exposing them to more demanding tasks, the movement patterns are going to break down. The capacity is not going to be there. And then some kind of closed chain strength as well. So are they strong enough to tolerate the ground reaction forces that you get when you do jumping landing tasks as well? And then, yeah, late stage, similar. Late stage is just, are they ready to go back to return to sport training? So probably the biggest thing for me on late stage rehab is that return to sport testing is not return to sport testing. For me, return to sport testing is late stage testing. It means now you're ready to go into a return to sport program, which should take 3 months. So when people pass return to sport testing, it's like, okay, yeah, now you're ready to do actual return to sport training. So your ability to hop doesn't mean you're ready to play sport. It just means that you've restored sufficient hop capacity. You can start to do now cutting mechanics and change of direction. And you can go through that on-field rehab plan and gradual return back to play. And I think that's the bit that's really missing in a lot of ACL rehab is you have this 3 month return to sport period, return sport continuum, following return sport testing. Return sport testing is not clearance to go back and play. For me, it's clearance to commence return sport training. And yeah, obviously I probably missed a couple of bits in there, but that's pretty much the general gist of criteria. Just a couple of things. It gives you It gives you objective data to know they're progressing well, but it also gives you objective data to hold people back, because a lot of patients don't complete rehab programs. So the general public, the hardest thing is, can you just get them to the end? You don't need the fanciest program in the world. You just need to keep them as long as possible. Too many of them go back too early. So if you've got some objective data there, then you can say, look, you're not quite ready. You need to do, you know, certain, even if they do it at home, whatever it is, but they shouldn't be going back to sport until they've hit those milestones. But yeah, the more challenging bit is the literature that's out there is not amazing. And there's a lot of gaps in our knowledge base around what's the actual criteria you need to hit. So a lot of it's based on anecdotal experience and then some common sense, just around, you know, if someone's got a 10% deficit in their uninjured leg, in their injured leg versus their uninjured leg, then this person got injured when they were, you know, when they were stronger. So now they've got a weakened graft. So it takes about 2 years for the graft to get fully recovered. So now they've got a weakened graft. You shouldn't be sending them back with worse movement patterns, lower levels of strength, lower levels of conditioning, because they're at an even higher risk of getting re-injured. So if anything, you should be at 110%, not at 90%.
Would you mind just giving us a bit of detail? That's great, Matt. Really good and incredible amounts of detail for people to take on board there. For the return to sport testing, which then allows that 3 month period to commence the return to sport training, what does that testing look like? Then we'll get into the complex movements versus pre-planned stuff as well.
Traditionally, what it looks like is a series of hot tests. So typically, the conventional hot tests are kind of single leg hop for distance, triple hops. And then you've got a 6 meter timed hop. And this is coming from the noise work and a lot of stuff from the inside of MACLA and a lot of good research out of the US. It is a clinically friendly tool in that if you've not got loads of kit and you've not got loads of time for testing, it does give you some good information. But your ability to hop versus your uninjured side doesn't mean you're ready to go back and play sport, because what started to become more aware now is we need to know, can you cope with the demands of training and match play. So can you cover 12K? Can you do a certain amount of accels and decels? So it's not just doing one hop, it's being able to tolerate the overall volume of multiple hops and change directions and decels. And so that's kind of where that bit's missing. Some people will do isokinetic testing or isometric testing with a handheld dynamometer to look at the quad strength, maybe the hamstring strength. Now, that should be pretty standard testing, but it's not. And I think there's some research out there showing that only 1 in 4 people get tested with like an isokinetic machine or a handheld dynamometer before they go back to play. So that's your typical testing. And then it's normally a surgeon clearance or a doctor clearance. So what they're doing is looking at range of motion, stability, you know, have you got swelling? What's your quad bulk? So they'll get you to do a knee extension. So just a quad squeeze and look at your quad bulk. Yeah, sports scientists would be like, well, it's not hardly a good measure of muscle size, just looking at the way someone can activate their quad. But yeah, it's normally like surgeon consensus, typically hop testing and quadricep testing is pretty standard. Now psychological readiness is also becoming pretty common. There is the psychological readiness questionnaire. So it's called the ACR Return to Sport Index from Kate Webster. There's a 12-question version, a 6-question version. That's quite useful to use to look at the readiness of the athletes. Again, really clinically friendly, easy to use. But that's the typical testing. Also, what should happen at late stages, you should have a measure of movement quality. So there's some excellent work coming out at Aspetar. They've shown that, you know, when we're hopping, we're looking for a horizontal distance. The problem with that is compared to the uninjured leg, which means if you pass it, it's normally because the uninjured leg is not very good and you've not preserved that. And if you fail it, it's because, yeah, that leg's just not fully recovered. But horizontal hopping is more hip extension and calf than it is knee. So mostly what we're concerned with here is that it's normally the knee extensors that are the main problem. But if you do horizontal hopping, the overall contribution of the quads to hop distance is only about 25%, but the deceleration is about 60% quad or knee extensor. So the main impact there is it's horizontal acceleration is less compromised by the knee, but deceleration is more compromised. So the great work coming out of Aspetar has shown that you can have similar hop distance, but then when you land, you have like a knee avoidance strategy where you're offloading to the hip and the into the calf. So I would say you need to be looking at deceleration kinematics, so the quality. And if you're going to be looking at power, don't do a horizontal hop, do a vertical hop, because vertical jumping is more knee dominant than horizontal hopping. My recommendations for late stage testing is basically, have you overcome muscle imbalances? So that should be the quad, the hamstring, but ideally also calf, and then, you know, hip abduction, adduction, particularly if you're, you know, in your professional team setting, you've got access to, you know, Valsport products, for instance, the Force Frame, the Nordic hamstring one, you've got the, you know, some force plates. There's a lot of testing you can do there. And that's standard testing for a lot of players. So that should also be standard testing for ACLs as well. But basically, have you overcome strength asymmetries? Have you overcome movement asymmetries? Are they physically fit enough to go back to return to sport training? And then is the knee sufficiently sound? Normally what people look at is the knee sound and are they able to hop? The movement testing, which we might come on to a little bit later anyway, more around the movement, but the movement testing should just be, can you move safely during a range of functional tasks in a pre-planned way? Because if you can't do it in a pre-planned way, when you go back to return to sport training, where there's contact, perturbation, decision-making, neurocognition, all this decision-making stuff, it's only going to get worse. So if you can't move in a pre-planned cut, you can't move in a realistic cut. So it's just making sure they've restored those pre-planned movement qualities. And then they're just ready to go back to return to sport training. So again, on-field rehab. And then you're focusing on getting them progressively back to the team as well. To summarize that, for me, late stage testing should be very different to what it is conventionally. You should be looking at, have they overcome muscle imbalances, at least 90% limb symmetry index in a quad and a hamstring, 90% limb symmetry index in closed chain strength and power, good movement quality during single leg squat, jumping and cutting and deceleration tasks, sufficient physical fitness to start training as well. And if you tick off all of those boxes, then when they do go back to return sport training, all the ingredients are there to progress nice and quickly as well.
Perfect. Again, amazing detail. So thank you very much. Let's dive it into this pre-planned change direction and transition into a more chaotic environment. Do you have the key things in terms of movement quality that you're looking for during them pre-planned change of direction that enable you to say, okay, I think this athlete is ready to go into a more chaotic environment?
Yeah. So the first bit here is, task selection is pretty key. So I think the biggest issue for me around movement testing is that the people are using the wrong tasks that don't reflect the sporting demands. So, you know, if you do like an FMS, which is a great tool, but there's no landing really there. There's no jumping. The timing and the level of intensity of those efforts don't reflect that sport. So for me, I look at, how do people get injured? What's the biomechanics and what's the situations in which they get injured? Our testing should to some degree reflect that. So first off is, just because you can do a good single leg squat doesn't mean you can do a good single leg landing, doesn't mean you can do a good single leg landing under realistic situations where there's contact, for instance. So I do like a single leg squat because it means, is the foundation pattern there? But the foundation pattern, the single leg squat, it has the same pattern as a single leg decel, as a single leg landing. It looks identical. So if you use a 2D, you know, camera, basically it's exactly the same. The main difference is the intensity, the time. Do you have time for feedback? So is it feed forward motor processing or is it feedback motor processing? When you're doing a single leg squat, you've got time for feedback. When you do a single leg landing, it's too quick. You don't have time for feedback because that whole reaction time is about 250 milliseconds. So, for me, there is just, what's the task selection? So the task should reflect the intensity, the ground contact times. It should reflect stretch shortening cycle nature of movements. And it should basically reflect those biomechanical demands of how people get injured. So in terms of the testing, I like to use a single leg squat, a single leg landing, a bilateral jump, a unilateral jump, and then like a change of direction as well. And the reason what we'd be looking for then is, can you just do those tasks with good technique, and are they not major compensations? So the big compensations you see after a knee injury, is there a knee avoidance strategy? And that just means that they can't effectively load through the knee, so they compensate at the hip to offload that. So in the sagittal plane, if you land with 3 times body mass, there's a certain amount of load that has to be absorbed via the knee, ankle, and hip in the sagittal plane. If the knee extensor has an avoidance strategy, it will offload to the hip. So the hip will take, say, 60%. The knee will only take 20%. So what you do there is, it's just, can you move with good kinematics during a range of functional tasks? If you can, the necessary biomechanics is there. So you've probably got sufficient strength, you've got sufficient patterning to be able to move in that way. And then after that, you're more concerned with what happens under realistic contexts, in that, can you process that information during a sports task really well? But yeah, what we really look for is good control in the frontal and sagittal plane during a range of different tasks. And the reason I say range of different tasks is because it allows you to look at what's the problem. So if you've got a good single leg squat, but a bad single leg landing, it's probably not the foundation pattern. It's probably not joint range of motion, or probably even strength symmetries to some degree. It's probably more like eccentric strength. It's probably like a timing problem, in that the main difference is that the timing is a lot faster. You've got a lot of rate of absorption. So the main difference there is, you've got a good pattern, you can't handle that pattern under high load. So that's why I like a range of tasks to look at what's the problem.
Superb. Superb. So we'll get to this more chaotic environment. We've established the pre-planned stuff is acceptable, and we think everything's safe, movement quality is good. We've looked at all the different assessments that you've just mentioned there. Where do we start in terms of introducing that chaotic nature of a task that, again, is, yes, pushing the athlete or the patient forward into that environment, but also doing that safely? What would be your kind of step one?
So first bit there would be, at this point, based on kind of my on-field rehab plan and that of Matt Taberner's, which are pretty similar. So you've kind of got 5 stages. So far, where we should be at is, we should have done the first 2 stages. So for me, late stage rehab is the first 2 periods of on-field rehab. It's all much more controlled. It's much more pre-planned. So you can do that alongside the stuff you're doing in the clinic as well. But by now, you can do a good change of direction under pre-planned scenarios. But what we need to do now is recognize that just because you can move well under that context doesn't mean you won't move, you can't do it well in sport-specific contexts. And the main things there that I consider are cognitive loading, so the kind of level of cognitive loading. And this is all based on our attentional capacity. So we've got a certain amount of attentional capacity that we have. We devote a certain amount of that attentional capacity to movement, and then we devote a certain amount of attentional capacity to our environment. But during pre-planned tasks, the environment is really simple. You've just asked them to run forward and cut a cone or a force plate. So the attentional demands from the environment is really small, which means our attentional capacity, our limit, is not going to be overwhelmed. But once you start overwhelming someone's attentional capacity, the amount of effort that they can put towards doing the cut, that gets reduced. So the problem here is just that you can move well under one context. That's because you're not challenging their neurocognition. So what you've got to start to do is just to gradually make the environment more and more complex, start to adding in more decision-making, more thought processing. And what that's doing is, it's challenging that spare space. So an element of it is neurocognition, thought processing, decision-making. Can you start to make that more and more complex? So what I would do there is, obviously start to add in something in the environment. So it could just be change of direction, get them looking in the environment where holding up different colored cones. So rather than run towards the cone and cut left or cut right, you've got reactive, of course, so pre-plan versus reactive. So you start to add in a reactive stimulus there. So rather than saying, run forward and cut the cone, run forward to the cone, and when I put my hand up or cone up, I want you to cut at that point. So it's just, reactive. And what we know is that reactive change directions make us move worse than pre-planned. So there's always this drop-off, and there's a bigger drop-off in ACL patients than there is in normal patients. And that's because the level of attention they have to give to the movements a lot more. So there's a bigger drop-off in their performance. So I just have loads of those different levels with like complexity. So rather than run forward and cut a cone, I might give them three or four choices. So the cone, the left or right, is simple. So I might say, okay, I want you to cut left or right, or I want you to a 180 turn, or I want you to do a 45 degree cut. But you might give them five or six different decisions to make that more thought provoking. Or you might give them different color cones. So I want you to run forward. If I put the cone up, I want you to cut left. If I shout left, I want you to cut right. And just give them lots of different bits around that just to get them thinking a bit more. And then you try and throw them into things like tag, where they've got to, you know, all you got to do is run forward, a little tag game like we used to do at school, all the great games. But there, what they've got to do is they're running towards you. They've got to now look in the environment, got to look where you are. They've got to make a decision. They've got to know when to accelerate, decelerate. So you're just making that more and more complex in terms of the decision making. Alongside that stuff, I would also add in contact-based work as well. So pre-planned movements with contact. So 25% of ACL injuries involve, 44% of ACL injuries involve some kind of non-contact, indirect contact mechanism, so a push or a shove, typically to the upper body. So now start to get them to do pre-planned movements, but with a bit of contact as well. So that could be using ropes, using Swiss balls, just pushing them, a little bit of contact to get them to maintain that overall control. I'd also add in the technical-based drills as well, but again, this is separate. So what I'm trying to do there is look at all the different components, but treat them separately. So neurocognition, decision-making, contact, fatigue, and technical-based gestures. I layer all of those up separately. So the technical-based skills are first pre-planned. Their fatigue stuff is during pre-planned scenarios. So try and fatigue them under cutting and try and give them mechanical perturbation under pre-planned movements. And then you just start to add them all together. So can you now do a technical-based gesture with two or three decisions? And then start to add both of those up, make the technical gesture a little bit more complex, add in the number of decisions. You're just trying to layer everything up progressively until you get back to sport. It's just seeing each of the dimensions as a component that you've got to layer up. Now, there's no set way of doing that because you look at all of those different things. There's an infinite number of ways of doing it. There's no perfect way. But it's just recognizing how can I just safely get them back to sport and just adding in all these different areas. I don't know if that makes sense or...
Makes absolute sense. And again, incredible detail. Is there anything that you would do to kind of pass them off to go into training? Or is that very much a subjective thing? Or is there a checklist? How would you approach that?
Yeah, it depends. So obviously different teams have their different ways of doing it. Now, it partly depends on what's the philosophy of the club. So are they allowing a player to come into modified training or do they need to enter full training? So I have different scenarios for me working in private practices. Some clubs would say, okay, well, you're handling that player. When they come back, they better be ready for full training because we're not touching their rehab because they just don't want to be involved in that. Because, you know, sometimes a player goes privately, it can create political storms. So they might say, prepare that player for full training or even prepare that player for matches, which I've had before. And it might also be that you're handing that player back and you know that the medical team it's not a top medical team in the UK. There might be a medical team abroad that hasn't got the same staffing, resources and knowledge. And you might be thinking, okay, well, I'm sending this player back with some advice and they can get played quite quickly. And I've had that before, sending a player back to a country abroad and they played him the first week back. They actually played that player twice within a week. Full games, and so they're kind of like, what are you preparing them for? Where's the border?
Did he survive that?
Sorry?
Did he survive? Did he get through it?
Yeah, no, he's right. Yeah, no, he's good. Yeah. Obviously there I got to we kind of over prepared him on that basis, knowing he probably wouldn't have done if you'd have sent him back saying, oh, he's ready for modified training. You send him back and he's ready for modified training, he probably would there'd be an issue. So you're just trying to, what are you preparing them for? Ideally, you've got really good close communication and you know exactly what you're preparing them for. And I've had some ACL injuries from some very good medical departments in the UK where their staff members have come across, they've looked at where they're at and you have a really good handover. You know that you're preparing that player for modified training at most, or they might even take that final period. They might say, okay, we want to do a week or two of him here, because ultimately, once you hand him back, it's the club's responsibility. So, you know, they might go, you know what, we're not going to throw him straight back into training. We'll do a little bit of work just as a safeguarding approach for ourselves. So there's no, like, you have to do this. It's very much based on the context in which you're preparing him for. But for me, to go back into full training, they must have sufficient workload. So they must have, you know, at least a chronic workload of 70%, which is a bit theoretical because we don't actually know what it is. There's very little research. We're doing a tiny bit at the moment around that. But again, it doesn't matter if it's 70%, because all you do to say to the team is, okay, the person's at this chronic workload. Okay, like, you know that you can't push them too hard. So if you've got good communication channels, they're not going to go and smash that player and do too much. So, but make sure they've got sufficient workload. They've done every single task. They're able to do 1v1s. They're able to do at least sort of 2v1, 2v2 scenarios. If they can do that, they can probably go back into team training. On the proviso that they don't go back into match play, in terms of like team training match play. But yeah, they should have done every single task as part of the on-field plan. They should have passed return to sport training, testing to go into the on-field plan. They should have good workload. And then that's pretty much it. At the moment, the bit I'm interested in is once you finish that on-field period, there's not a great amount of on-field testing that happens. In terms of, there's no real tests there that we do and go, right, you're safe to go in, back into training. It's kind of like you do your on-field plan. You might do some physical fitness testing. So what's their speed? What's their strength? What's their power? You do your normal needs analysis, your normal profiling stuff. But there's no like real on-field test at the moment that's kind of a clearance test. And that's something I'm interested in and like to do some more research in. Is that like, can we run our players through like a match simulation test and know that they're safe and that they can move well under realistic scenarios? Because we're still a little bit dependent on that movement test, that they're moving safe. We don't know that now they can move well when they're fatigued. You can use cameras on the pitch and expose them to it. But yeah, there's still a little bit of guesswork, but ultimately you should just be gradually making those demands harder and harder. Ideally, return them back to modified training, back to full training, then full training plus top-ups, and then you're just preparing them back into match play. And then the team then will be responsible. But normally most teams are going, you know, full training plus individual work, return back to lower level. So development team, reserve team, play 30 minutes, 45 minutes, 60 minutes, and gradually increase those match minutes. But teams have been doing that for years, at least in the UK. Actually, surprisingly, because I chatted to some good people in the UK, and I did a paper in BGSM around the frameworks and the return to sport continuum. And I felt, based on my working with people in Europe that and other countries afar, that it was quite interesting. But people in the UK were like, Matt, we've been doing this for years. Like, it's his standard stuff. But then there's a lot of people not doing that. So they don't have processes where they're going from training to match play. Some coaches in certain countries think once they're ready to train, they're ready to play. They don't see a difference between training and match play. So it's just knowing what you're sending them back to, what's the medical team you're sending them back to as well.
Of course. Right, mate, I've kept you for nearly an hour. And I've said it a million times already, and I'll say it again, incredible amounts of detail in that, taking us through pretty much the whole journey. So thank you very much for that. If there's anyone out there that wants to get hold of the latest paper or anything else you've done previous, what's the best place?
So obviously bits of my stuff on Twitter, I always put the papers on Twitter. So it's just, yeah, kind of M_ is it, the little dash underneath there, Bookthorpe, for the Twitter handle. Most of it will be on ResearchGate. So you can go on ResearchGate. ResearchGate's a good one if you can't get access to papers and they are behind a paywall. A lot of people will have their papers on ResearchGate. A lot of my stuff's open access as well, so you can just type the papers in and it will be on there. But ResearchGate's a good one because it has a list of papers for all of those, for that author, and you can just go in. A lot of them are available as well. But yeah, probably my Twitter, I'll make sure the papers are on there. And then, yeah, just stick it into Google, but also reach out via email. So yeah, we're generally happy to send work. What we can't do is say, oh, here's a PDF, we'll put it up on on LinkedIn or whatever, because we're not allowed to do that. But you can go through ResearchGate and do that, or just send us emails. And, you know, anyone emails me, I'll happily send them whatever papers they, whatever they need. And a lot of my stuff's translational research, so I wrote it to try and help, like, translate stuff into practice. So the worst thing for me is if no one reads it. Otherwise, what's the point? What's the point writing it? So, yeah, no, happy to share that. My email, happy to share that. That's mbookthorpe@hotmail.com. If anyone wants to email me on that, I am, yeah, very happy to send some work out to them as well.
Top man. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your time. Look forward to keeping in touch and seeing what else comes out. And, yeah, thanks again. We'll speak soon.
Cheers, Will. Thanks a lot for
having
me.
Cheers, Matt. Thanks, mate. Thanks for tuning in to episode 469 of the Pacey Performance Podcast. It was an absolute pleasure to chat with Matt, and as I'm sure you'll agree, the amount of detail that he went into for this episode was incredible, so I really appreciate Matt coming on the Pacey Performance Podcast. Also, big thanks to Team Builder, Rock Daisy, Vald and Hytro for sponsoring this episode today. The podcast could not run in its current form without these guys, so I really do appreciate all their support. Big thanks to you for tuning in, and look forward to chatting to you next time.